She didn't see anything after that. Later she would say she had seen it all. The corpses piled onto the pavement like cakes in a window. The rickshaw pullers dead with their heels on rickshaw pedals. The tank-sized holes in the dormitories. But as they clattered through the compound, her eyes had been closed, squeezed shut against the sight of her ruined city.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulibi. This week, Bangladesh-born author Tamima Anam reads from her first novel. It's called A Golden Age, and it's set against the country's 1971 War of Independence. It's about a widowed mother who reluctantly becomes a revolutionary and a hero. Anam got her PhD in social anthropology at Harvard. She traveled to Bangladesh and listened to the stories of people who survived the war. She said a novel was the only way she could possibly convey what it was like to have lived through that time. This reading of A Golden Age took place in January of 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thank you all for coming. I'm thrilled to be here at this very venerable institution. I can feel standing here that there have been many, many people who have stood at this very spot and probably written books much more interesting and important than mine, but I'm thrilled to be here and to join their ranks. A Golden Age is set against the backdrop of the Bangladesh War of Independence. And it's about the war, but it's primarily about the life of one family and one character named Rehana Haq. Rehana Haq is a widow, and the novel actually starts 11 years before the war, when Rehana has suddenly lost her husband. And as a result of losing her husband, she is fighting a custody battle for her children. Her husband's older brother is seeking to take custody of the children, claiming that as a widow and having very little means, she won't properly be able to take care of them. And she loses custody of the children, and they're taken away from her for a number of years. And this particular event is the founding moment of her life. And for the rest of her life, she says she's trying to repay a debt that she owes to her children for allowing them to be taken away from her. And all the decisions that she makes during the course of the war and in her life are affected by this moment of loss. She's always trying to recover from that moment. So while the book is set against a very heated and very intense political time, it's also a very intimate story, and it's about how Rehana survives the war. And by the time the war begins, her children are teenagers, and she's determined that they are going to get through the war with their family intact. And this is her journey, and this is her goal throughout the book. In the short passages that I'll be reading to you, I'll be focusing on Rehana's journey, and particularly on her growing sense of political identity as the novel progresses. When the novel begins, she's a very ordinary woman. She's a housewife. She's a widow. She's a mother. And this is her whole world. She lives in a small house in a neighborhood called Dhanmondi, which, if any of you have been to Dhaka, you know it well. It's a residential neighborhood. And she doesn't really know much beyond Dhanmondi and beyond Dhaka. I'll be reading to you mostly passages that have to do with how Rehana becomes politicized. And she's a very reluctant revolutionary. But by the end of the book, she becomes a nationalist. She becomes heroic through the decisions that she makes throughout the war. And because she is plunged in the midst of this very extraordinary moment in history. The first scene that I'll be reading to you takes place at a very historic political rally on March 7th, 1971, in which Sheikh Mujib, the leader of the Awami League and ultimately the leader of the nationalist movement, gives a very fiery speech inspiring people to resist the Pakistani occupation. And Rehana is persuaded by her children to attend this rally, and this is what happens. The scene appeared before Rehana like a glamorous black and white picture. There was the white of Mujib's kurta pajama, the black of his short coat, the black, she knew, though she could not see, of his thick framed glasses, the white of the tent pitched to cover the stage. By the end, she found herself shouting, "Joy Bangla! Joy Bangla! Joy Bangla!" with the crowd. the rhythm of her words chiming with the hard thump of her chest, and she recognized at once the incendiary thrill of shouting. Maya, her daughter. Maya looked over at her mother and flashed her a wide, encouraging smile. Rehana suddenly felt young, plunged into a world of limitless possibility. At 38, Rehana's body had finally caught up with its history. People who did not know she was a widow used to assume she was a student or that she was unmarried because she didn't wear a wedding ring or a single piece of gold jewelry. But no longer. She had gained a little weight, and she enjoyed the occasional heaviness of her limbs, the stubborn outward curve of her belly. Her new, comfortable shape came with new imperfections, the bowed line between nose and chin, the slight shadow above her lip. All fortunate developments for Rehana, as they signified the battle-weary body of a woman who had passed years in the effort to raise her children. Maya leaned over and held her mother's hand, not as she sometimes did for a reassuring squeeze, but in solidarity, and suddenly Rehana felt sure it would all resolve itself. Sheikh Mujib would be prime minister, and the country would go on being her home, and the children would go on being her children. In no time at all, the world would right itself, and they would go on living ordinary, unexceptional lives. And of course, this feeling of hope that she has at the end of the scene is very short-lived, because less than 3 weeks later, on the night of March 25th, the Pakistan army lands in Dhaka and begins a campaign of a massacre, a campaign of genocide and ethnic cleansing, which results in the tremendous loss of life that we know to be the Bangladesh War. And it begins with this night in Dhaka when the army lands in the city and begins firing indiscriminately at the civilian population. And the main center for their attack is the university, where much of the movement was born, where it's the heart of the movement, it's the university, the students, the professors. And they also, of course, target the Hindu neighborhoods of Dhaka. About 2 days later, the curfew is lifted, and people are allowed to leave their homes and see what's happened to their city. And the next passage that I'll be reading you is what Rehana sees that morning. Everything seems almost the same, Rehana thought. The new market gate was shut, and the little shops around its entrance were boarded up, and the vendors selling jackfruit and amra were nowhere to be seen. Still, it could have been Friday afternoon, when everything closed down for the Jumma prayers, or it could have been another strike. They'd had so many strikes lately. The rickshawwala pedaled past the roundabout before entering the university compound, and here the air began to change. There was a low-lying fog clinging to the pavement. No, it was smoke whispering through the streets, leaving an ashy, sour taste in the mouth. It got thicker as the rickshawwala brought Rehana closer to the dormitories. He stopped, unraveled the cloth from his head, and tied it around his face. He motioned for Rehana to do the same with her sari. She held the sari to her nose and with one hand clung tightly to the rickshaw frame because the road was uneven here. When she looked down, she saw scraps of litter scattered across the street. She thought she saw a prayer cap and a pair of unbroken spectacles. People must have dropped their things as they ran. She wanted to pick up the spectacles and wave them around, see if anybody was looking for them, but the rickshaw had already driven past. Now there was a thin length of red ribbon on the road. She leaned over. She couldn't be sure. It was glistening wet. They continued, and the rubble grew denser. Rehana became aware of the growing crowd on the street. The rickshawwala strained to get them through the uneven road and the people that were laced around them. Now there were bricks and bits of plaster and layers of dust that had settled on the road and turned it gray-white. They were in front of Curzon Hall. The wet ribbon had followed them all the way, and now it poured into a gutter which was also red, and on the side of the gutter was a pair of hands, the fingers clasped together in prayer or begging, and next to the hands was a face. The mouth was tiny, only a pale pink smudge, like the introduction of a bruise. It was a little girl. Her hair swallowed the top half of her face. Beneath the clumped together strands, Rehana could see an eye squeezed shut. She wrenched herself away from it. She looked for only a minute, but it felt like so much longer, felt so close she thought she could smell the girl's breath escaping from her nostrils. "Move on," she said to the rickshawwala. She didn't see anything after that. Later she would say she had seen it all, the corpses piled onto the pavement like cakes in a window, the rickshaw pullers dead with their heels on rickshaw pedals, the tank-sized holes in the dormitories. But as they clattered through the compound, her eyes had been closed, squeezed shut against the sight of her ruined city. So this is what the world looked like after the massacre. And, of course, this moment changes everything in the lives of the people in Bangladesh and for this particular family. And in particular, Rehana's son, Sohail, who is 19 years old, asks whether he can join the resistance. And Rehana, even though her impulse is to say, please don't go, I want to protect you and keep you at home, again, because she feels indebted to her children, she can't say no to anything they ask of her. So he asks her, can I go and join the resistance? I have to go. I'm a patriot. I can't watch this happening and stand back and do nothing. And she says, okay. And he leaves the house, and the city starts adjusting to occupied life. And she's now alone in the house with her daughter. And this is what it is like. And it's now May, so the war has begun in March, and it's now May. Already 2 months ago felt like the distant past. It was May. They had been at war since March. What was strange had become unstrange. They were used to seeing the green uniforms wherever they went. They were used to returning obediently to their homes at the peal of the curfew siren. And they were used to the dusty, empty streets, the closed shops, the hospital with locked gates, the half-full baskets of the fruit vendors. The landscape of war was becoming familiar, and they had all found their ways to live with it. So by the time Sohail returned to Dhaka, the city had settled back into a sort of routine. He came in the middle of the night and stood at the foot of Rehana's bed. Later, she would say she had known all along that he was there, that she deliberately kept her eyes closed, savoring the relief of having him back and alive. But really, she'd slept through the whole thing, his entrance through the gate, his stealthy sidestepping of the furniture and the medicine boxes, the deep breath he took before uttering her very favorite word, Ma. So he comes back, and they have a meal together, and then this is what happens. It was almost dawn by the time they finished eating. Get some rest, Sohail. He looked around as though deciding whether to speak. Ammu, I need to ask you something. He waved his hand and drew her closer. Some of the guerrilla operations will take place here in Dhaka, he began, and we need a place in the city to store arms, a safe place to hide out before and after the operations. As he looked at his mother, there was no hesitation. Our mission is to disrupt the normal functioning of the city, make sure the world knows what's going on. People will not just stand by and witness the rape of Bangladesh. I've come here to find shelter and to recruit more men for the guerrilla regiment. Rehana imagined the journey Sohail had taken to come here, eluding the barricades around the city, the powerful searchlights that scan the docks of the river. She imagined someone in charge, a military man, taking one look at her son and knowing he would be the right one to send back to Dhaka. She wanted to be more angry and less proud, but she found herself wanting to say yes, not just so that she would have Sohail's confidence, but because she could not blame anyone but herself for making him so fine. This was who she had hoped he would become, even if she had never imagined that her son or the world would come to this. And she knew what he was asking her. You want to use Shona? Shona is the name of their house. Yes. Shona with her back to the sun. Shona that had given her the children. Proud, vacant Shona of the many dreams. The house is yours, Sohail, Rehana said. Your birthright. So this is what happens. Sohail begins to use Shona as the center for the resistance in the city. And one day he brings home a wounded soldier, and he tells his mother this man has saved his life. And that she needs to look after him and hide him until he recovers. And again, Rehana says yes. She agrees to hide the man in her home until they recover, and they, of course, form a friendship because it's just the two of them in this big house, this empty house, in the midst of this war, and she's going to his room every day to change his dressings and to bring him his meals and to, you know, take care of him, and they slowly start to develop a friendship. One of the things that happens in the course of this friendship is that this man, who is only called the Major, he doesn't have a name, he listens to a record, a Nina Simone record, and because Rehana has lent him her gramophone because he's bored and he's recovering, he has nothing to do, and she happens upon him listening to this very strange music that she has never heard before, and this is what happens. And I hope someone will ask me a question later about why I put the Nina Simone song in the book. It was a woman. In every syllable, Rehana could hear the delicate intake of her breath, the tongue caressing the palate, and the slow, tender piano in the background. And as the song built, she could hear melancholy and a low, guttural moan and stretched out vowels. Her voice was a thousand years of sorrow. Rehana tried to make out the English words. I loves you, Porgy. Who was this Porgy? The song was like the weather, a thing that was everywhere and nowhere all at once, the words falling into each other like overlapping raindrops, a dry day and then a wet one, the scale rising like a gust of wind. Sometimes it was as though the woman was holding her breath and then releasing it. She was young, almost girlish, and then her voice would go deep, with the confidence of a secret masculinity. The weather filled the room. It traveled across the corridor until it rose up in Rehana. By the time she had gathered the courage to enter the Major's room, she found herself a little out of breath. She told herself it must be the fast walking, carrying the heavy tray, trying not to spill the milk. She tried to stir up some irritation at the Major. She put the tray down in front of him harder than she meant to. Her name is Nina Simone, the Major said. Nina sounded like a Bengali name. Rehana had a melting feeling in her mouth, as though she had bitten down on a pink, overripe guava. So as you can imagine, Rehana and the Major fall in love. And it's one of the few tender moments in an otherwise very harsh reality that's going on all around them. And actually, I don't think it was just my romantic notions that I wanted to put a love story in the book. It was that, you know, I went to Bangladesh and I interviewed a lot of people who survived the war. And although a lot of their stories were about fighting in the battlefield and about the great tragedies that had befallen them, the loved ones that they had lost, many of their stories were about how their relationships had changed because they had been a party to this very extraordinary time. And a lot of the stories they told me were love stories because women and men were thrown together under very unusual circumstances and allowed to mix in ways because they were involved in student politics or because, you know, it was a war and the normal rules didn't apply. So you mustn't think I'm overly romantic for putting in this love story. People did fall in love. This is the last passage I'm going to read. And it sort of signifies the moment of Rehana realizing that she's not only a mother anymore, she's now really a part of this movement. And what happens is that she not only has been hiding the Major in her home, but a young boy named Joy has also been hiding out in her house, and he's a friend of her son Sohail's. And Joy's brother Arif was also in the war, but he dies in an earlier sort of chapter. And Joy comes to Rehana and says, my brother has died. And the day that he comes, he is wearing Sohail's shirt. He's wearing Rehana's son's shirt. And as he's about to tell her, my brother has died, all she can think of is, why are you wearing my son's shirt? Has something happened to him? So this is the background to this particular passage, and this will be the last thing that I'll read. And the next day, there were three sharp raps at the door. Rehana rushed to the drawing room, her heart racing, because these days it could be anything. Sohail, news of Sohail, a letter from Maya, a telegram saying they were both dead or captured or hurt somewhere. Or it could be the army, or a spy, or someone pretending to be a spy, or someone pretending not to be a spy. It could be anyone. The woman was carrying a silver tray. There was a bowl on the tray, a blue porcelain bowl with a white napkin on top. The napkin had golden tulips embroidered along its edge. Something hot and fragrant was inside. Rihanna caught a whiff of raisins as the woman, standing in the doorway, said hello. "I'm Joy's mother," she said, a little apologetically. "Joy and Arif." She had a plump, dimpled face. "Mrs. Bashir, yes, of course, please come in." Was she coming to ask about Arif? Rihanna seated her on the sofa. She tried not to stare. "No matter how hard you look," she told herself, "you won't be able to know if she's telling the truth." "May I offer you some tea?" "No, please, I just came for this." The woman pointed to the silver tray, which she had balanced on her lap. The raisin smell wafted through the room. Mrs. Bashir paused a little, then placed her palms on the tulip napkin. She had big hands and ragged fingernails. "Can you please give this to Joy?" The words came out quickly, as though the woman was afraid her courage would suddenly leave her. Did she know Arif was dead? If she did not know, did this mean she was telling the truth, or did it mean she was lying? "I'm sorry, I can't do that." "It's nothing, just moruk pulao." "I'm sorry, I don't know where your son is." "Your son is dead," Rihanna said to herself. "The other son, who was wearing my son's shirt, has gone to bury him." "Yes, yes, of course you don't know." She paused, then said, "Perhaps Sohail can bring it to him." Mrs. Bashir looked at the doorway, and Rihanna could see the anxiety, the cautious curiosity, and a little jealousy, perhaps, towards another woman, another war mother, who might know something she didn't. "Sohail is in Karachi," Rihanna said carefully, "with his aunts. Perhaps you know someone who might pass this on. It's his favorite," Mrs. Bashir said. "I know no one," Rihanna said, as though she had spoken the words 1,000 times before. "Please, Mrs. Huck, you are a mother also." "You are a mother." How many times had she repeated this very phrase to herself? "I'm a mother. Above all things, a mother. Not a widow. Certainly not a wife. A mother." But now she was something else. A mother, yes, but not just of children. Mother of a different sort. This mother knew what it was to long for her children. But she also understood the dangers of such longing. "I'm sorry. I know you miss your boys." "Have you seen them? How are they? How is Joy and my Arif?" She didn't know her son was dead. Rihanna started at the thought of Arif lying in a grave somewhere, restless and unmourned. She wanted to touch the woman's rough hand, but it could so easily be a trick. Maybe it wasn't her son. She had to pretend she didn't know anything about it. To test herself, Rihanna looked straight into Mrs. Bashir's eyes and said, "I don't know. I haven't seen them since the war began." That's all. Thank you. Yes, please ask many questions.
Okay, I have two short questions for you. Say the last decade, there have been many Indian authors that have published in the West. Mm-hmm. Are you the front end of a Bangladeshi literary invasion, or are you are you a sort of unique writer? And what is the literary scene in Bangladesh? And second question, countries that are usually torn apart, you think of Germany, Ireland, Korea, Vietnam, China, spend their next many decades trying to get back together again. I have the impression that after the war, that the two countries, Bangladesh and Pakistan, promptly lost interest in each other. Mm-hmm. Is that, I mean, what would your generation now think of Pakistan? Do you have any connections, or is it just another country now?
Well, I'll answer your second question first. I don't think there's any threat of Pakistan and Bangladesh getting back together. No. We're very proud of having our own country now. I think the relationship between Bangladesh and Pakistan is quite complex. On the one hand, we didn't have a national kind of reckoning like a truth commission. None of the war criminals of the Bangladesh war have ever been tried. There's never been an official apology from the Pakistan government. So I do think that, along with the fact that there are a lot of political controversies around the war, I think that makes it so that it's very difficult for people to actually put the past behind them and to heal from the past. So a lot of these wounds are still raw. And if you talk to people in Bangladesh about the war, it's as though it just happened yesterday, not 37 years ago. People are very passionate about it. Having said that, because of Bangladesh's even more complicated relationship with India, there is a kind of fraternity between Pakistan and Bangladesh based on the fact that they're both Muslim countries and have a lot of similarities in some of the troubles that we share, namely some of the political troubles, the influence of the military. So I do think that it's not a completely fraught relationship. There's a lot of friendship now between Bangladesh and Pakistan. And, of course, most Bangladeshi support the Pakistan cricket team, and that really has caused a lot of the bridges to be built between the two countries. As for your first question, as you know, in Bengal, we have a very rich literary tradition. And in Bangladesh, there is a thriving literary culture, but it's in Bengali. It's not in English. But I do hope that more Bangladeshi authors will be able to come out in the wider world, as has happened not only in India but in Pakistan. You know, there are many internationally known Pakistani authors now. I'm going to Bangladesh next month and teaching a creative writing workshop to try to get people excited about writing in English. I would teach one in Bengali, but my Bengali is not good enough. So yes, I do hope that there will be many, you will see many more Bangladeshi authors. In fact, although the U.S. government really supported Pakistan during the war, the ambassador, the American ambassador to Dhaka, that was posted in Dhaka at the time, his name is Archer Blood. He really stood up for Bangladesh and wrote this very famous Blood telegram to the State Department saying that we can't stand back and witness this genocide. And of course, this destroyed Archer Blood's diplomatic career. And he's considered a great hero in Bangladesh. He launched his memoirs there. We all got to meet him. And it really was a moment of one man kind of standing up and this telegram is now a document of what really was happening at that time, and it sort of is there for all for posterity. And so,
I had two questions. One was about why Nina Simone.
Right. Thank you.
And the other was about Dhaka. I was reading a book and it referenced what it was like prior to the British Empire mm-hmm. coming in, that it was a magnificent place mm-hmm. and they were producing better steel than mm-hmm. they produced in England. And this was news to me, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, I just know about the struggles and sure. The black hole of Calcutta yeah. and things like that. So mm-hmm. if you could, I don't know if you touch on that in the book, on the history of Dhaka. Mm-hmm. But so I was wondering okay. about what you know about that okay. history and Nina Simone.
Sure. Thank you. Well, I don't really go into the history of Dhaka except to mention that Dhaka was a provincial outpost before it became the capital of a country. And during colonial times, it was a beautiful city. It was called, you know, the Venice of the East. And there's so many cities called the Venice of the whatever. But the university was a very internationally known center for academic excellence, Dhaka University. And you can still see the kind of vestiges of that. If you see the buildings, they're very grand, and you can tell it was envisioned as a very important university. But of course, after the partition of India, Bengal was cut off from its main metropolis, which was Calcutta, and the whole region really suffered as a result. It's like having a field in one side of the border and a well in the other. In other words, the agricultural heart was in the east, but Calcutta was the industrial center, and without the industrial center, the rest of the region, the rest of East Bengal, East Pakistan, really foundered and really had trouble kind of bringing itself back up. And I mean, of course, one can't trace one historical moment as being the cause of all of a nation's problems, but certainly that was something that contributed to Dhaka not and the whole area, but Bangladesh having a little bit of trouble kind of coming out of that legacy. So that's a small answer to your question. The Nina Simone song, well, there are two reasons. One is that most people who write novels for the first time write novels about their own experience, or many do. And there's very little of me in this book because I wasn't even born when the war broke out. So I felt that I should be allowed to have something in this book. And I put in one of my favorite songs, this Nina Simone song, as a sort of little note to myself to remind myself that I was indeed the author of this book. And you'd be surprised at how I would need to do that, because I went back to Bangladesh, and this professor of English at the University of Dhaka was talking to me about the book, and she was getting her students to do a kind of dramatic reading from the book. And the reading was getting very long, and I said, oh, well, maybe you can cut out this passage. It's not really, you know, that important. And she said, oh, but this is a really important moment. I mean, you wouldn't understand because you weren't there, but this is crucial. And I thought, well, I wrote the book, but okay. And it's actually a wonderful moment because I think I was very privileged because people in Bangladesh really owned the story as being their story. And I think it was a time for people to be able to reflect, people who lived through the war, for people to be able to reflect on what had happened, and a time for them to speak about their experiences. Maybe some of them hadn't really talked to their children about them, and everywhere I went, I'd said to people, go and ask your parents about where they were in the war. You'll really learn something. So yeah, I will leave the Nina Simone answer at that.
Hi, thanks for coming and speaking to us. I have a two-part question. First part is that I am from Calcutta, and like many Calcuttans, I have family from Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. And so much of what I know about Bangladesh is secondhand. So from my understanding of the war and of that time period is that during the Golden Age, Bangladeshis had this the sense of identity that was Muslim and Bengali, and mm-hmm. they were compatible. And currently that dynamic is shifting. There's more tension between the two identities. Mm-hmm. And so my first question is, what do you think of that, and what have you experienced? And the second part is that what impact has that tension had on Bengali as a language and how mm-hmm. it's spoken and written there? Mm-hmm. I know you said you don't speak Bengali as mm-hmm. much, but mm-hmm. I was wondering if you can address those.
Sure. Well, it's a very good question, and I'm sure a lot of us can think about situations in which culture and religion are sometimes at odds with one another. During the Bangladesh War, people were fighting a war of independence for their cultural and linguistic identity. This country that was Pakistan was brought together under the auspices of religious unity. And so when people were breaking away, it was their cultural and linguistic identity that they really emphasized. And Bangladesh was born as a secular nation based on a Bengali culture. You know, our constitution is very secular. It's the People's Republic of Bangladesh, not the Islamic Republic of Bangladesh. But of course, you know, things have changed around the world, geopolitics, there has been a resurgence of religious identity in Bangladesh, as there has been in many places in the world, not just in the Muslim world. I do think, however, that this tension is more apparent in the political sphere, where people use religious rhetoric to make a political point. I don't think it's as much of a tension for people's everyday lives, because people practice their religion and their culture quite seamlessly. And this is evidenced by the fact that Bengali is still very much, you know, one of the most important aspects of our cultural and political and everyday life. You know, primetime television in Bangladesh is a recitation of poetry by Tagore. That's what people tune in to watch. So really, there is really no threat of Bengali being overshadowed by any other kind of identity. Although, you know, I think that it's important for those of us who value the fact that we are not only a Muslim country, but a secular country, for us to kind of really stand up for that and to try to make our voices heard. So thank you for your question.
I want to thank you once again. I think you're a great ambassador of Bangladesh, and I'm really impressed with the book. And like you, I'm also a part of the post-71 generation and with the freedom fighter father. I wanted to ask you a question because, as you mentioned earlier, people really own this story and they've really connected with it to an extent when they're like, you don't even know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. I was there. So with that kind of perspective, what were the challenges for you in writing it and then afterwards? Were there anything that was hard to overcome or to write about because of you knew, I'm sure, how much detail people would go into with everything you were writing?
Sure, that's a great question. I suppose it was, I took on a very big kind of burden in writing the story because it's close to so many people's hearts. And I was thinking about that a lot. And at one point, a mentor of mine said to me, stop being so dutiful, because I thought, oh, I have to get all the details right. And I was very particular about talking to people about some of the small things that really made a difference, like what they used to wear and what kind of cigarettes they smoked. I mean, I really was doing my research. Of course, one can never be completely perfect and accurate, especially because I wasn't there. I tried my best to capture something of that time. But one of the things that made the novel for Bangladeshis wonderful in that they took it on as their story, and it was a you know, people responded to it very warmly, was something that was also slightly problematic, because it's sometimes hard for people to realize this book is a work of fiction. So they'd say, oh, well, you know, you got this fact wrong, or why are you talking about this political leader or not and not the other? Why does Sheikh Mujib make the speech or whatever? So it's hard to say to people, well, this is a work of fiction, because I can't say, well, I made it all up, because actually a lot of it is based in reality and is based on stories of my family and of people that I met. So I think this is both one of the pleasures and one of the challenges of writing a book that is based on an event that means so much to so many people. So
thank you for coming. Your reading was just beautiful. You are an anthropologist, and one question just is coming again and again in my mind after reading after Bhutto's death, that she was a Sindhi, mm-hmm. Baluchis are rebelling, mm-hmm. and other ethnic minorities mm-hmm. in Pakistan. In India, where I come from, always we think in a broader scale, unity in diversity. Mm-hmm. What is the situation of ethnics, minorities in Bangladesh? Mm-hmm. Does the grandmother has any mm-hmm. reflection on that?
Well, it's a very good question, actually. And I know someone said I was could be an ambassador for Bangladesh, but I also sometimes feel that it's important for me to point out that as a nation, we have a lot of flaws, and one has been the treatment of ethnic and religious minorities in Bangladesh. We have a lot of indigenous people in Bangladesh whose lands have been taken away, who've been systematically excluded from jobs, from education, from other opportunities. And I think it's one of the most shameful aspects of our nation. And I think it partly has to do with the fact that when the nation was constructed on this Bengali identity, not everyone was Bengali. There were other people who were not, who didn't speak Bengali. They were Manipuris. They were, you know, Adivasis. They were Shantals. They didn't speak Bengali. And so this was a way for the political rhetoric to kind of embrace everyone, not really understanding that the embrace could also be smothering. And in fact, we have a much smaller Hindu minority in Bangladesh than we did in 1971. And I think that, you know, I would say it's not a very often spoken about aspect of our country, but it's one that really needs to be said. I think that's a great something I'm personally very ashamed of.
It will be said. Now we are reading more about Sindhis sure. and Baluchis
Absolutely,
and
yeah.
other minorities in Pakistan. Mm. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming. I actually had kind of a general question. So growing up with me, my family's from India, mm-hmm. and my grandmother is an artist, and so we always talk about Indian culture and Indian prose and mm-hmm. arts, I guess, would be mm-hmm. the thing. But my question is, my grandmother always kind of portrayed this stereotype of Bengali mm-hmm. is the most cultural identity of,
sure.
you know, everything was always, yeah. oh, the Bengali identity yeah. is very artsful and mm-hmm. cultural within mm-hmm. All of the region. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering what you thought would be the reasons as to why that stereotype mm-hmm. came about mm-hmm. and possibly... I know, which my grandmother said, she's
pride.
Like, it's true, you know, they all, it's fact, and that's exactly how she says it, and we're Gujarati, actually, so, here, you know, you think of the Gujaratis as the business people of India, and so it's very much where she's like, mm-hmm. no, these these people, it's in their blood to be artistic. And I was wondering what you thought was the reason.
Well, I think a lot of these categories we've inherited from colonialism. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the colonial administration had to describe the martial races and and they saw the Bengalis as being soft. They wouldn't make good military men, but they would make good clerks. So part of it is based on a kind of, historical legacy. But partly it's because Bengal has produced such wonderful literature. And Tagore is only one of the many, many people that influenced writing not only in Bengal, not only in the subcontinent, but all over the world. And so I think that partly has something to do with it. I mean, I can't really tell you what it is about Bengali's like DNA that makes them more culturally oriented, but sure.
In general.
Yeah, I do. I'm so glad you pointed out that stereotype. And my non-Bengali friends say, oh, you Bengalis, you're such snobs. You know, you think you own the cultural world, so.
Thank you very much.
I want to congratulate you. It's wonderful to see you again after so many years and to see you with such a lovely accomplishment. I'm enjoying reading the book.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you, since I've known you, I guess, for 20 years now.
This is Aruna Roy, a wonderful family friend. And we first met when my family and I moved to Thailand, sort of in the mid-80s. So I was, 10 or 11.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to kind of to follow your path, and you were at Harvard and you studied social anthropology. One of the things that I remember when we were in Dhaka was that there was a beginning of a movement to try to document what actually happened during the war, because so much of it was kind of hidden or erased, and the new generation didn't really know about that. So there was that little sort of museum, if you remember,
yes.
Bonani. And I was wondering why you chose the path, being trained as a social anthropologist, why you chose the path to write fiction, as opposed to nonfiction. Your father being an editor of a newspaper, clearly you could have gone in that direction, even if you wanted to tell the story only of individual people's lives.
Sure.
And I'm curious why this choice.
Thank you for that question. I suppose the answer is very simple. I mean, when I went to Bangladesh and met all these people who had survived the war, their stories really touched my heart. And I thought about them all the time. And the only way that I thought I could convey something of what it might have been like to have lived through 71 was to write a novel. I think there's something very special and alchemical about reading fiction. And if it's done effectively, you can really be transported. And with all due respect to all the other forms of writing, I think it's very difficult to do that with any other medium. So that's why I chose fiction, and then I had to kind of go about learning to write, because I was trained as an academic, and I had to forget a lot of my academic training that told me to be objective and to not presume to know what people were thinking, and to try to give a broad sense of the history. I had to abandon all of that. So that was my kind of personal task. But there are still in Bangladesh a lot of great oral histories that are being put together about the war. Some young anthropologists, historians, political scientists who are doing that job much better than I could have done, because my heart was elsewhere. So it's being done. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.